is Wealth Wake Up with Dick Donahue on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham and KGMI.com.
Welcome to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Thanks, as always, for being with us. Well, big question here. Should the Federal Reserve be audited? You know, several years ago, some politicians started demanding that the Federal Reserve get audited. We think the idea does have some merits, but also some drawbacks as well. One problem with the Fed is that it doesn't have a hard limit on its own spending. For example, let's say the Fed wanted to hire a bunch of extra staff to write papers on climate change, income inequality, gun control, or other political hot-button issues of the day that don't really have a direct relationship with monetary policy or the Fed's mission. Well, our understanding is that there's nothing to stop the Fed from doing so, as long as it claims some relationship to monetary policy, no matter how tenuous. And even if the appointed leaders of the Federal Reserve Board object, there are still 12 regional reserve banks around the country that could do so, and their leaders are not appointed by the president or confirmed by the Senate. In fact, the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank already has staff dedicated to researching topics that impact the greater good and community development. So depending on the party in power, auditing the Fed could lead Congress to mandate more or less of these endeavors, and at the same time put more political pressure on the Fed to tilt monetary policy in a way that politicians see as favorable toward themselves, which would mean less Fed independence. History shows clearly that less central bank independence correlates closely with higher inflation and less currency stability. But what we suggest is a law that limits the Fed to activities that directly, not indirectly, impact monetary policy. Those areas could be measured with an accounting audit by an outside firm, which the Fed already does. Last week, the Fed released an audited financial statements for 2023, and they were, well, interesting. Most prominently, the Fed lost $114 billion last year. This is the first time the Fed has ever run an annual loss, and the loss is a direct consequence of the financial panic of 2008 when the Fed started paying banks to hold their reserves. Prior to that change, the Fed did not pay banks to hold reserves, meanwhile earning interest on the securities in its portfolio, mostly treasury bills. But after the change, when the Fed was holding rates down to zero, it still ran surpluses. When the Fed held rates low, it contributed an average of more than $75 billion annually to government revenue. But holding rates too low creates distortions in financial markets, and rates had to go higher. So in order to normalize rates, the Fed now pays banks 5.4% on their excess reserves. The result is that the Fed paid private banks $281 billion in 2023. But the Fed earns less than that on its bond portfolio. To repeat, it lost $114 billion in 2023 and has a total accumulated deficit now of $133.3 billion since 2022. The Fed calls these accumulated losses a deferred asset because it expects to return to profitability in the future. But these kinds of losses should invite political oversight. Does the Fed just borrow more from the Treasury, us, the taxpayer, to meet payroll? If so, there's already a reason to doubt its independence from the political side of government. Rather than audit the Fed, which is already done, laws which require more transparency and more focused mission would be productive. The Fed has become too political, and that should change. Take a look at our global roundup for the week. We found that you can't hurry cuts. You're just going to have to wait. Global equities were lower on the week, and rising interest rates and firmer oil prices. The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note rose 16 basis points to 4.38% from a week ago. The price of the barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude oil rose nearly $5 to $87, and volatility as measured by the CBOE Volatility Index, or VIX, rose to 16.5 from 12.9. And taking a look at the U.S. labor market employment report for this week, we saw that the labor market remains robust. U.S. non-farm payrolls rose stronger than expected, 303,000 in March, while the payrolls for the prior 2 months were revised up 22,000. The unemployment rate dropped a tenth of 1% to 3.8%. Average hourly earnings were in line with forecasts, rising 0.3% month over month and 4.1% from a year ago. The odds of a U.S. Federal Reserve interest rate cut in June eased after this strong report. The first cut now fully priced for September after being priced for July ahead of the data. Markets now anticipate fewer 2024 cuts than the three forecasts by the Fed policymakers. 10-year Treasury yields rose about 7 basis points towards the top end of their recent range, near 4.4%. We also saw some subdued U.S. services sector offset bounces in manufacturing. So surprisingly strong ISM manufacturing data released on Monday revived the market fears that the U.S. economy remains too strong for the Fed to cut rates as soon as or as much as investors have expected. The manufacturing index rose to 50.3 in March from 48.3 in February, the first expansion in this sector since September of 22. New orders also rose into expansion territory, while the prices paid index jumped to 55.8 from 52.5. That's rekindling inflation concerns. However, Wednesday's reading on the much larger services sector was more benign, dropping to 51.4 in March from 52.6 in February. The prices paid component fell to 53.4, a four-year low, from 58.6. That combination helped quell fears that rate cuts will be delayed for months, though Friday's strong employment report revived them. And we saw Fed Chair Powell. He's undeterred by bumpy inflation. Kashkari, Logan are not so sure. The Fed Chair Jerome Powell helped allay fears that recent bumpy inflation data will alter their trajectory of expected rate cuts. In comments Wednesday, Powell said it's too soon to say whether the recent firmer inflation data is more than a blip. The data did not materially change the overall picture, he said, adding that he doesn't think inflation is reversing higher. The Fed chair added that based on the current outlook, rate cuts are likely to be appropriate this year and that decisions will be made meeting to meeting. And on Thursday afternoon, hawkish comments from Federal Reserve Bank Minneapolis President Neel Kashkari caused a stir in the markets when he questioned the need for rate cuts given the economy's resilience and raised the possibility of no cuts this year. Those remarks, along with a spike in oil prices on rising Mideast tensions, helped spark a rout in the risk aversion, sending the S&P index down about 2% from Thursday's intraday highs. Friday morning, after the employment report, however, Dallas Fed President Lori Logan said that it's much too soon to think about cutting rates. And we're seeing that Mideast tensions are escalating. An Israeli airstrike that demolished Iran's consulate in Syria on Monday killed 2 Iranian generals and 5 officers, according to Iranian officials, the Associated Press reported. The strike appeared to signify an escalation of Israel's targeting of military officials from Iran, which supports militant groups fighting Israel in Gaza along its border with Lebanon. On Thursday, Israeli Defense Forces scrambled GPS signals around Tel Aviv and other parts of Israel to make the retaliatory airstrikes by Iran and its proxies more difficult. Israel also called up reservists from its aerial defense unit and temporarily paused leave for all combat units. Brent crude oil rose above 90 on Thursday amid the heightened tension. Also on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The White House said that Biden made it clear to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that U.S. policy will be determined by Israeli actions aimed at improving the humanitarian situation in Gaza. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back shortly. Thank you, as always, for being with us.
Why West Edge Credit Union? Because they're all about the community. Of course I like that West Edge has low interest rates and loan specials. But what I really love is that West Edge partners with local nonprofit and City of Bellingham organizations. Plus they put on events like Community Shred. And they talk to me like I'm a real person, not an account number. West Edge really cares.
Join West Edge Credit Union today. West Edge is federally insured by NCUA. West Edge Credit Union, on the corner of James and Alabama in Bellingham.
KGMI wants to put a grand in your hand. You could be one word away from a chance to win $1,000.
That's right. Just listen each weekday to KGMI for the keyword during the 8 a.m., 11 a.m., 2 p.m., and 5 p.m. hours.
Then go to the Grand in Your Hand contest page at mybellinghamnow.com before midnight and enter each keyword for your chance to win $1,000.
We'll have four keywords each weekday so you can increase your chances of winning by entering all four every day we play the contest.
You already listen to KGMI for the latest local news and discussion of the latest issues. Now you can win $1,000 while you do it.
A Grand in Your Hand is brought to you on KGMI by Niederhaus of Luxury, Whatcom County's newest fine jewelry store, next to Lombardi's on Bellwether Way.
A Grand in Your Hand is back on KGMI.
Get details at mybellinghamnow.com.
We don't have the usual traffic jams that they have in the big city, but sometimes things happen to snarl everything up. Depend on KGMI to keep you cruising to your destination with KGMI traffic alerts. We'll tell you where the trouble spots are, and if you see problems on the road, give us a call at 360-676-5464 so we can spread the word. KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM, and KGMI.com.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KGMI or the Cascade Radio Group.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife.
Welcome back to Wolf Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning. Got questions for us? Give us a call. We're Asset Advisors. We are located out on the Pacific Highway in the Pacific Commerce Center, out halfway out of Mount Ferndale, out next to Wilson's Furniture. Our address is 5060 Pacific Highway, Suite 101, Ferndale, 98248. Our phone number, 360-733-1200. And check out our website at wealthwakeup.com. And I also announced yesterday, I'm probably going to have some tickets available for the Mariners' next home series. They come back and they play the Chicago Cubs, and they play Cincinnati. Those games will start on the 12th. I got some requests for some of those tickets. I got to confirm them, but you can give me a call, 360-733-1200. I might have four tickets and a parking pass. I'll let you know. Well, let's continue on with our global roundup and look at some of the quick hits from around the globe this week. And we saw that Fed Vice Chair for Supervision, Michael Barr, said Wednesday that the U.S. banking system remains sound and resilient, though the Fed is looking at banks' level of unrealized losses and their exposure to commercial real estate. Issues in the office real estate market are going to take some time to resolve, he said. And according to the Investment Company Institute, assets in the U.S. money markets hit a record $6.11 trillion in the week ended the 3rd of April. Consumer prices in the Eurozone rose a less than expected 2.4% year over year in March, while the core measure beat expectations as well, rising only 2.9%. We saw President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping held talks by phone on Wednesday. Among the issues discussed were AI risks, concerns over China's support for Russia's military industrial base, and climate change. And in March, China's manufacturing sector expanded for the first time in 6 months, with the Purchasing Managers Index rising to 50.8 from 49.1 in February. The non-manufacturing measure rose to 53, which is its highest reading since September. In the Eurozone, the composite PMI turned positive in March for the first time since May. In line with positive readings in Japan and the United Kingdom, the global economy itself seems to have reached a positive inflection point. A recent surge in demand for industrial metals backs up this view. We saw U.S. light vehicle sales rose 5% in the first quarter. And on a visit to China, U.S. Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen warned China about using excess industrial capacity to produce goods that the global economy cannot absorb. And according to the Financial Times, European residential property prices fell for the first time in a decade last year, declining 0.3% in the European Union and 1.1% in the Eurozone. Germany's housing market was one of the worst hit, suffering a decline of 8.4% on an annual basis, second only to Luxembourg's 9.1% drop. In an interview with Japan's Asahi newspaper on Friday, Bank of Japan Governor Keizo Yuri said that the central bank could respond with interest rate hikes if weak yen and rising wages push up inflation. We also saw an interest rate-sensitive Canadian economy shed about 2,200 jobs in March. Canada's unemployment rate rose to 6.1% from 5.8% in February. And the strongest earthquake to strike Taiwan in 25 years killed at least 12 on Wednesday and temporarily interrupted the island's production of critical semiconductors. By the end of the week, nearly full production had resumed at chip giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, according to the company. Well, let's take a little bit more of an in-depth look at the March employment report that came out on Friday. And the labor market showed strength in March, good news for workers, but bad news for those hoping for an early or more aggressive rate cuts from the Federal Reserve. Non-farm payrolls rose 303,000 in March, which is the largest increase in 10 months, and they were revised up to 22,000 for prior months, bucking the general trend of negative back revisions. Meanwhile, civilian employment, which is an alternative measure of jobs that includes small business startups, increased a robust 498,000 in March. Much has been written lately about whether the immigration surge at the border is a force behind solid growth or continued job growth. If so, you'd expect job growth within the payroll survey to beat the growth of civilian employment, which is based on a survey of households that probably fails to measure illegal immigrants. That didn't happen in March. When employment growth beat overall growth, it's it appeared to cover the past year as payrolls have grown 2.9 million, while the unemployment measure is only up about 600,000. The alternative reason for the general trend of slower employment growth is that this is what sometimes happens when the economy is at a turning point towards a recession. In the meantime, there is plenty of other news in March. The average weekly hours increased to 34.4 from 34.3 in February. Total hours worked rose to 0.5% for the month. In addition, average hourly earnings increased 0.3%, and they're up 4.1% in the last year, which is running a little ahead of inflation. The labor force rose to 469,000 in March, pushing the participation rate back up to 62.7%. However, not all the news was quite as good. We do like to follow payrolls excluding government because it's the private sector, education and health services because it rises for structural and demographic reasons and usually doesn't decline even in recession years, and also leisure and hospitality, which is still recovering from COVID lockdowns. The core reasons of payrolls rose more modest, 95,000 in March, is only up 61,000 per month in the last year. Also, the household survey shows full-time employment down in the past year, which usually only happens in and around recessions. In addition, given the strength in headlines overall payrolls, the Fed has to question whether monetary policy is really tight, given also the CPI inflation remains stubbornly above 3%. As a result, the Fed could stay higher for longer, which could hurt more when the effects of tighter money eventually bite us. Let's take a look also at the February International Trade Report. The trade deficit in goods and services grew to $68.9 billion in February as imports rose faster than exports. However, we still prefer to focus on the total volume of trade, which would be imports plus exports, as it shows the extent of business and consumer interaction across the U.S. border. This measure grew substantially in February, rising by $13 billion, pushing total trade volume up 3.4% from a year ago. Exports are now up 4.1% versus a year ago, while imports are up 2.8%. Notably, there's a major shift going on in the pattern of U.S. trade. Through the first 2 months of the year, imports from China were down 1.7% versus the same period in 23. China used to be our top exporter in the U.S. Now the top spot is held by Mexico, as China has fallen to number two, with Canada nipping at its heels. Meanwhile, global supply chain pressures have eased substantially over the past few years. This was confirmed by the New York Fed's Global Supply Chain Pressure Index in February, and the index moving back into positive territory. It was up 0.11 standard deviations below the index's historical average. For some perspective, 2 years ago in the month of February, the index sat at 2.77 standard deviations above the index's historical average. Expect some temporary volatility, though, as Yemen's Houthi rebels continue to deter container ships from transiting the Red Sea, adding volatility to shipping costs. Also in the report, the dollar value of U.S. petroleum exports exceeded imports once again. This marks the 24th consecutive month of the U.S. being a net exporter of petroleum products. In employment news, initial claims for jobless benefits rose 9,000 last week to 221,000, while continuing claims declined by 19,000 to 1.791 million. So some interesting numbers to keep an eye on. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break. We'll be back after a bunch of advertising here, I think. Thanks for listening. Be right back.
We don't have the usual traffic jams that they have in the big city, but sometimes things happen to snarl everything up. Depend on KGMI to keep you cruising to your destination with KGMI Traffic Alerts. We'll tell you where the trouble spots are. And if you see problems on the road, give us a call at 360-676-5464 so we can spread the word. KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM, and KGMI.com. Breaking news, Bellingham. KGMI.com is now MyBellinghamNow.com. You don't have to change a thing if you already rely on KGMI.com to stay in touch with KGMI and your community. We're committed to keeping you informed with the latest, unbiased news, and we're committed to keeping it completely free. No subscription, no commitment, no cost. MyBellinghamNow.com.
When you buy a Subaru from Dewey Griffin, you're buying more than a vehicle. You're buying safety for your family, an investment that will hold its value, and reliability that will last a long, long time. Simply put, you're buying trust. Stop by Dewey today and check out their huge inventory of 2024 Subarus, from the 8-passenger Ascent to the Outback, Forester, and the sporty Impreza, and the all-new Crosstrek. Dewey Griffin Subaru. Community-minded, community-driven, and the only Subaru-certified tire and service center in Whatcom County.
Hey, this is Deanna Haraluk with KGMI's all-new Pet Pulse. I'm a pet parent myself, and we all want the best for our critters, whether they're furry, feathered, hooved, or otherwise. The segment is brought to you by Whatcom Veterinary Hospital. Did you know that one in four pets suffer from obesity? Pet obesity can shorten your pet's lifespan by up to 2 years. Contact Whatcom Veterinary Hospital for a wellness exam today. And tune in to KGMI's Pet Pulse Wednesdays during the morning news at 6:20 and 7:50, and during the afternoon news at 5:20, right here on KGMI.
Hey, I just finished my spring carpet cleaning early this year thanks to the help of Swan's Clean Care and Restoration. Amazing as always.
Really? I'd love to have Swan's Clean Care clean my carpets, but isn't it expensive?
With Swan's, it's a lot less than you think. And with their new referral program, we'll both get a nice discount. Just go to their website, then call and tell them I sent you.
Fresh, clean carpets? Swan's, here I come. Hey, what's that website?
Swanscarpetcleaning.com. But hurry, it's only happening through May 31st.
Business owners, you have job openings? We have HireMeWa.com. HireMeWa.com is Cascade Radio Group's hyper-local job board. It's free and easy to use. Upload your available job listings today. Job seekers can post resumes too. HireMeWa.com is available 24 hours a day. Check back frequently. New job listings added regularly. HireMeWa.com. Business owners, post your job openings for free right now at HireMeWa.com. That's HireMeWa.com. HireMeWa.com is a service of Cascade Radio Group and this station.
This is Heidi Person, General Manager of the Cascade Radio Group, with a look at some good news in our community that we like to call the upside.
T-Mobile recently awarded $10,000 to the Ferndale Food Bank. In total, five Washington and Hawaii nonprofits received an equal portion of $50,000 as a part of the company's quarterly Difference Maker Awards. Ferndale Food Bank was selected for their efforts, serving a community relying on them now more than ever in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Co-director of the food bank, Sierra Cook, announced the funds will go directly to providing community access to food. If you have a business and would like to become a community partner or to volunteer, get info at ferndalefoodbank.org.
The Upside is brought to you by R.B. Wick and Bellingham Coin Shop. Stop by today for a free coin or antique evaluation. 1806 Cornwall, one block south of Bellingham High School, or at bellinghamcoinshop.com.
If you have good news to report, email it to us at theupside@cascaderadiogroup.com.
My son Finn was born with congenital heart disease. He ended up spending about the first 8 months of his life in the hospital. During that time, he endured 10 surgeries, including an open heart surgery. Starlight Children's Foundation has played an important role in my family's life. For 5 weeks when he was a baby, Finn lived in a Starlight Hero wagon. You could not understand the pure joy of having him go from a hospital bed into his favorite red wagon. Starlight doesn't just give items that hospitalized kids can use to keep themselves happy, but also memories, moments, and experiences which are so needed in times like these. They allow sick kids to just be kids for a little while. The support that Starlight provides to families like mine is an integral part to creating happiness at a time when there's very little to be found. Learn more about how Starlight Children's Foundation brightens the lives of sick kids by visiting starlight.org today.
The latest local news and important topics of the day from the West Mechanical Studio.
Rest easy in a cool home this summer. Contact West Mechanical Heating, Air Conditioning, and Electrical to add AC to your existing system for as little as $140 a month. Find them at westmechanical.net.
Get the latest news and information 24/7 with KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at mybellinghamnow.com.
Welcome back to Wolf Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you. Okay, let's continue on with our economic reports that we received this week. And we saw the February personal income and consumption report also come out. And consumers remain healthy. Inflation remains a concern. Let's start with the PCE prices, which is the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation, which rose 0.3% in February, bringing the 12-month comparison to 12.5% from 2.4% last month. If the Fed wants confidence and evidence that inflation is sustainably trending towards its 2% before starting rate cuts, this report was not very helpful. Core prices, which exclude ever-volatile food and energy categories, rose 0.3% in February, and they're up 2.8% versus a year ago. The Fed has prioritized a subset of inflation dubbed the supercore, which is services only, no goods. It excludes food, energy, and housing. That measure rose 0.2% in February, is also up 3.3% versus a year ago. So no matter which measure you choose, they all remain above the Fed's 2% target, and given ongoing shipping disruptions in the Red Sea, as well as unexpected events like the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse near Baltimore, we would not be surprised to see volatility in the inflation numbers in the months ahead. Looking toward the consumer in February shows income and spending both on the rise. Personal incomes rose 0.3% in February, following an outsized 1% gain in January. That was lifted by the annual cost of living adjustments to Social Security and a jump in dividend income. Income gains in February were led by private sector wages and salaries, which rose 0.8% on the month. They're up 5.4% in the last year. Meanwhile, the government pay rose 0.7% in February and is up 8.1% in the past year. That is the largest 12-month increase in more than three decades. So we don't think the growth in government pay is sustainable or good for the overall U.S. economy. Wage gains were partially offset in February by a drop in dividend income from January's elevated numbers. Consumer spending rose a robust 0.8% in February, while rising spending in both goods and services. The 1.4% gain in durable goods purchases was the largest single monthly gain since January of last year, as consumers picked up spending on motor vehicles and parts. That said, spending on goods is up a modest 0.8% in the last year, which is less than inflation, as consumption has shifted towards the service side of the economy. Spending on services rose 0.9% in February. That was led by financial services and insurance, which is up 6.9% in the last year. We expect services to continue to lead the charge in 2024, but with growth tempering as the economy slows. In other recent news on the housing front, pending home sales, which are contracts on existing homes, rose 1.6% in February after declining 4.7% in January. You're going to plug these figures into our model suggests that existing home sales, which are counted at closing, will decline for the month of March. And we also have the Institute of Supply Management's Manufacturing Index report for March come out this week. And the ISM Manufacturing Index showed some signs of life in March, rising at 50.3. That's beating even the most optimistic forecast from any economics group surveyed by Bloomberg. The reading above 50 signals that activity in the U.S. manufacturing sector expanded in March, although barely, snapping 16 consecutive months of contraction. So looking at the details of the report, half of the 18 major manufacturing industries reported growth in March, with 6 reporting contraction and 3 reporting no change. Both demand and production were responsible for the rise in the overall index, as the index for production jumped to 54.6 from 48.4, while the new orders index broke back into expansion territory for only the second time in the last 19 months. Survey comments described continuing demand softness, but optimism that order activity will pick up in the second quarter. Despite this optimism, demand remains soft in the manufacturing sector. When looking at the big picture, goods-related activity is artificially boosted during the COVID lockdown. But then the economy reopened and consumers began shifting their spending preferences back to a more normal mix, away from goods and back to services. The ISM index peaked in March of 21. That's the last month that federal stimulus checks were sent out, and it's been weaker ever since. We do continue to believe that a recession is coming this year and that the manufacturing sector is likely to lead the way. Case in point, hiring activity in the manufacturing sector contracted for the 6th consecutive month as companies continued reducing headcounts in March with significant layoff activity. We believe investors should remain cautious as the monetary and fiscal stimulus during COVID wears off. Last but not least, the highest reading of any category in the report came from the prices index, which increased to 55.8 in March. So after sitting in contraction territory for most of 23, the prices index has been above 50 each month in 24, also signaling higher prices. This is not a good sign for the Fed, as the goods sector has been a key driver for lower inflation readings over the last year. In other news, construction spending declined 0.3% in February, as a sizable increase in home building was not enough to offset broad declines across most other major construction categories. We also got the services sector, non-ISM manufacturing index report this week, and services continued to expand in March, but at a pace of growth has slowed. The headline index declined to 51.4 in March, missing the consensus expected 52.8, with 12 of 18 major industries reporting growth, 4 were reporting contraction, and 2 were reporting no change. So looking at the detail, the indexes for business activity and new orders, which is the 2 forward-looking pieces of the report, were a mixed bag in March. The index for new orders took a breather from the 6-month high it set in February, while the index for business activity ticked up to a solid 57.4. So along with slower new orders, the pullback in the headline index was due to faster deliveries in March, signaled by a lower sub-50 reading in the supplier deliveries index and the employment index remaining in contraction territory. Faster deliveries signal fewer bottlenecks and therefore the potential of weaker demand. Hiring activity in the services sector looks to be cooling, and the index sat in contraction territory for the third time in 4 months. Survey comments reiterate continued struggle finding qualified labor. While the number of major industries reported an increase in employment in March versus a decrease is nearly the same. On the inflation front, prices continue to rise in the services sector now for the 82nd month in a row. Although the index is well below the back-breaking pace of 21 and 22, inflation remains a problem in the services sector, 13 industries reporting higher prices during the month of March. So what do we expect this year? Well, we had an eventual weakening in services activity as the economic morphine from COVID wears off and the impact of recent reductions in the M2 measure of the money supply make their way through the economy. We continue to believe the recession is on the way. We think investors should stay cautious as we move through these unprecedented times. In other news, the ADP's measure of private payrolls increased to 184,000 in March versus a consensus expected 150,000. Also, cars and light trucks were sold at a 15.5 million annual rate in March. That is down 1.3% from February, but up 3.7% from a year ago. Well, you know, something that we run into as people get nearer to Medicare age, you need to know about IRMA. That's the income-related adjustment amount. Inflation-adjusted surcharges on your Part B and D for Medicare. IRMA surcharges, which first appeared in 2007 as part of the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003, kick in for 2024 just if you make over $103,000 adjusted income for single taxpayers and $206,000 for married couples filing jointly based on their tax returns from 2 years prior. IRMA rates are determined by tax return information from 2 years prior because many taxpayers file by an extended deadline in October, which gives the government insufficient time to set premiums if relying on just the previous year's tax information. So that's why they go back 2 years. Anyway, looking at these tables, your Part B Medicare premiums, if you single 103 to 206,000 joint, basically, under that, you do not have an adjustment. Between 103,000, 129,000, or 206 and 258, you have about adjustment of $69.90 a month. Between 129,000 to 161, or 258 to 2322, basically those numbers double, you're up to $174.70. Now, for those that have over $500,000 more of individual income or over $750,000 married, their premium jumped to $479.30. That is each. You also see similar increases in your Part D Medicare prescription drug plans. To give you an example, for those that are over the $103,000 or $206,000, they've got a $12.90 a month surcharge. That jumps all the way up to $81 a month per person for those that are over that $500,000 or over $750,000 or more. And so just to kind of keep in mind that IRMA is something you need to be aware of. There's a lot of things you can do. You need to plan your taxes. You need to maybe, you know, take a look at such things as Roth conversions. Also, maybe doing qualified charitable distributions from your IRAs if you're over 70 and a half. Those are all things that we can help you sit down and take a look at. We've got a program. We can actually scan your tax return in. So now that you're getting done doing your 23 tax return, give us a call. We'll scan that tax return for you and help you determine if there are some ways you can go to help avoid some of these costs. Dick Donahue with you with Wealth Wake Up here on KGMI. We'll be right back.
Have you really sat down and taken a good look at how much you're paying for home and auto insurance? I'm Derek Barnes, and by now you might know that my wife Denise and I own D&D Insurance in Ferndale. Over the years, we've seen individuals paying $300, $400, and sometimes $500 a year too much for their home and auto insurance. If we're going to be good stewards of the money provided to us, I think it's prudent we review our insurance and financial needs. Likewise, we've been given families to take care of, and if something untimely were to happen to us, it's good to know that we can still provide for our families even when we're not around. Life insurance gives us that opportunity. Don't put it off for another day. Pick up the phone and start making some wise choices. Call the agents at D&D Insurance. They'll point you in the right direction. 392-8159 or visit us online at dndinsurance.com. We look forward to meeting you.
The scariest, the strongest. incredible stories of patients who have had nurses and doctors visit them, only to find out that those people never existed.
Coast to coast.
A physician who died of a cardiac arrest in the hospital, but one of the nurses was on vacation and came back a couple of weeks later, got onto the elevator, and there is the doctor that died.
Every night at 10 p.m. on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham. Streaming live at MyBellinghamNow.com. Staying connected with your community each Saturday at noon with KGMI's Community Connection as local business leaders share their expert advice. Sponsored by
Lighthouse Mission Ministries, Dewey Griffin Subaru, Feller Heating and Air Conditioning, Contact Counseling, and Guided Solutions.
Community Connection, Saturdays at noon on KGMI News Talk 790, 96.5 FM in Bellingham, and streaming live at MyBellinghamNow.com.
Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
Welcome back to Wealth Wake Up. Dick Donahue with you this Sunday morning here on KGMI. Got questions for me? You can always give me a call, 360-733-1200. You know, it's time to start restore fading families. Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming all share common borders, something else that matters more. According to data from the Census Bureau gathered in 2020, these were three of the four states that had the highest percentage of households headed by married couples of the opposite sex. New Hampshire also ranked in the top four. In 2020, 57.8% of households in Utah were headed by married couples of the opposite sex. In Idaho, it was 53.7%. However, these are the only states in the country where the percentage of households headed by opposite-sex married couples constituted a majority of all households. In New Hampshire, which ranked third, only 49.4% of households were headed by opposite-sex married couples. In Wyoming, which ranks fourth, it was 48.9%. So rounding out the top 10 states where rankings by this demographics were Kansas at 48.5%, Nebraska at 48.5%, Minnesota 48.4%, New Jersey 48.3%, Hawaii at 48.2%, and Iowa also at 48.2%. So which states ranked at the bottom for the percentage of households headed by opposite-sex married couples? Well, New York came in last. Only 40.6% of households there were headed by opposite-sex married couples. Louisiana was next to last at 40.7%. Rhode Island and New Mexico were tied for second to last at 41.3%. The rest of the bottom 10, Mississippi at 41.5%, Ohio at 43.9%, Massachusetts at 44.1%, Alabama 44.3%, and Georgia at 44.7%. And although the District of Columbia, which is our nation's capital, is not a state, the Census Bureau included it in the data table that presented the state-by-state percentages of households headed by opposite-sex married couples. Had it been a state, the District of Columbia would have finished in last place by far. Only 22.8% of the households there are headed by opposite-sex married couples. In a majority of the nation's states, 31 out of 50, the percentage of households headed by opposite-sex married couples is at least double the 22.8% that the Census Bureau reported for the nation's capital. While married couple households made up the greatest proportion of coupled households, their share has been in a steady decline over the past several decades, the Census Bureau said in an analysis published this last week. From 1968 to 2009, the share of adults ages 25 to 34 living with a spouse decreased from 81.5% to 40.3%, while the share living with an unmarried partner increased 0.2% to 14.8%. In 2020, the Census Bureau expanded the data collection on American couples. The U.S. Census Bureau revised the relationship to householder question in the 2020 census to improve the quality of coupled household data after discovering issues with the measurement of coupled households in the 2010 census. The Bureau said in May 25, 2023 release, one revision included adding specific answer categories for opposite-sex spouse, opposite-sex unmarried partner, same-sex spouse, and same-sex unmarried partner. So in which states in 2020 had the highest percentage of households headed by an opposite-sex unmarried couples? Vermont led the nation with 9%. The top 10 also included Maine at 8.9%, Oregon at 8.2%, Alaska at 8.1%, Nevada 8.1%, New Hampshire 8.1%, New Mexico 7.6%, here in the state of Washington 7.6%, Wisconsin is also 7.6%, and Arizona and Rhode Island are tied with 7.3%. Utah, which led the nation with 57.8% of its households headed by opposite-sex married couples, tied Alabama for the smallest percentage of households headed by opposite-sex unmarried couples, 4.9%. Following Utah and Alabama at the bottom of this category were Mississippi at 5.2%, South Carolina at 5.5%, Georgia 5.6%, Virginia 5.7%, Texas 5.7%, New Jersey 5.8%, North Carolina 5.9%, Maryland at 5.9%, and Arkansas also at 5.9%. There were two other categories where the Census Bureau data showed that the District of Columbia beat all states. These were the percentage of households headed by married and unmarried same-sex couples. In our nation's capital, according to the Census Bureau, 1.2% of the households were headed by unmarried same-sex couples. 1.4% were headed by married same-sex couples. No state had even 1% of either of these categories. 14 states, including California, New York, and Massachusetts, led the other states with 0.5% of their households headed by unmarried same-sex couples. 4 states, including Hawaii, Massachusetts, Delaware, and Vermont, led the other states with 0.8% of their households headed by the married same-sex couples. The decline in the traditional family headed by a married mother and father is a decline for America. Traditional family life correlates with financial well-being. 2022, according to the Census Bureau, married couple households had the highest median incomes and the lowest poverty rate. The median household income for a married couple family last year was that year was $110,800 compared to $51,930 for a male household living in a non-family household and $40,200 for a female householder living in a non-family household. The same year, 6.9% of married families with children under 18 lived in poverty, according to the Census Bureau, while 37.2% of female householders with children under 18 and no spouse present lived in poverty. The 18.3% of male households with children under 18 and no spouse lived in poverty. In 1798, President John Adams sent a message to the Massachusetts militia. We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion, he said. Our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people, he said. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other. John Adams was right. Well, we're finding now that Americans are saying that they need $1.5 million in order to retire. The retirement is becoming an even more distant goal as higher costs cut into the American budgets. The typical person now believes that they need $1.5 million to retire comfortably, which is nearly 17 times more than the $88,400 that savers have set aside on average, according to a Northwestern Mutual study. The gap of 16% from last year highlights the challenges coming into focus on the over 65 population as the U.S. increases and Americans face the prospects of financing longer lifespans and potential cuts to Social Security benefits. People's magic number is now 50% higher than it was during the pandemic. Soaring costs are putting more pressure on consumers to plan and be disciplined savers. Everyone knows that they'll need more money as they live longer. Gen Z and millennials set the bar for comfortable retirement the highest, at least 1.6 million. Gen X was close behind, and the generation closest to retirement, the baby boomers, set the bar the lowest at 990,000. Boomers have a better feel for their numbers, and they believe they'll live as long as Gen Z, which expects to retire at 60 and live to 100. Breaking out the size of current retirement accounts by generation reveals the daunting obstacles for savers of all ages. The average amount saved were $22,000 for Gen Z, $62,000 for Millennials, $108,000 for Generation X, and $120,300 for Boomers. One way to help bridge this gap is through advanced tax planning of spread assets among accounts that are taxed differently. Many people put money into their 401ks, but they don't realize that in retirement, that income will likely be taxed at between 20 and 30%. Withdrawals from a traditional 401ks in retirement count as ordinary income, so they can push retirees into a higher tax bracket. Of the 30% of Americans surveyed who did have a plan to minimize taxes on retirement income, about a third said that they would make strategic withdrawals from their traditional tax-deferred and after-tax Roth retirement accounts in order to stay in a lower tax bracket. Northwestern Mutual's 2024 Planning and Progress Study was conducted online by the Harris Poll between January 3rd and 17th among 4,588 U.S. adults. So some interesting numbers there saying that you're going to need $1.5 million in order to retire. So numbers are going up. And our experience with our clients is there's probably a lot of reality to that. Once again, give us a call if we can help you, 360-733-1200. Don't forget our live show next Saturday at 11. Hope you have a great week. Got questions for me? Once again, give me a call, 360-733-1200.
Voiced on the show are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision.